It takes art to make sure the man does not suffocate, for if he does, everything he knows is lost. Over the next week, two dinner guests die. Fisher himself rallies. It is possible, he thinks, that the cook did speak, but that what he said was not for the ears of the ordinary subject. He goes to see Anne. A thorn between two roses, she is sitting with her cousin Mary Shelton, and her brother's wife Jane, Lady Rochford. "My lady, do you know the king has devised a new form of death for Fisher's cook? He is to be boiled alive." Mary Shelton gives a little gasp, and flushes as if some gallant had pinched her. Jane Rochford drawls,
"Fere dignum et justum est, aequum et salutare."
She translates for Mary. Apt. Anne's face wears no expression at all. Even a man as literate as he can find nothing there to read.
How will they do it?
"I did not ask about the mechanics. Would you like me to inquire? I think it will involve hoisting him up in chains, so that the crowd can see his skin peeling off and hear him screaming." To be fair to Anne, if you walked up to her and said, "You are to be boiled," she would probably shrug.
"C'est la vie."
Fisher is in bed for a month. When he is up and about, he looks like a walking corpse. The intercession of angels and saints has not sufficed to heal his sore gut and put the flesh back on his bones. These are days of brutal truth from Tyndale. Saints are not your friends, and they will not protect you. They cannot help you to salvation. You cannot engage them to your service with prayers and candles, as you might hire a man for the harvest. Christ's sacrifice was done on Calvary. It is not done in the Mass. Priests cannot help you to heaven. You need no priest to stand between you and your God. No merits of yours can save you, only the merits of the living Christ. March. Lucy Pettit, whose husband is a master grocer and a member of the Commons, comes to see him at Austin Friars. She's wearing black lambskin, imported, I guess, and a modest grey worsted gown. Alice receives her gloves and surreptitiously slides in a finger to appraise the silk lining. He rises from his desk and takes her hands, drawing her to the fire and pressing upon her a cup of warm, spiced wine. Her hands shake as she cradles the cup and says,
"I wish John had this wine, this fire."
It was snowing at dawn on the day of the raid on Lion's Quay, but soon a wintry sun was up, scouring window panes and casting the panel rooms of city houses into sharp relief, ravines of shadows and cold floods of light.
"That is what I cannot get out of my mind," Lucy says, "the cold."
And Moore himself, his face muffled in furs, standing at the door with his officers, ready to search the warehouse and their own rooms.
"I was the first there," she says, "and I kept in hovering with pleasantries. I called up, 'My dear, here is the Lord Chancellor come on parliamentary business.'"
The wine floods into her face, loosens her tongue.
"I kept saying, 'Have you breakfasted, sir? Are you sure?' And the servants were weaving under his feet, impeding him."
She gives a little mirthless whooping laugh.
"And all the time, John was stowing his papers behind a panel."
"You did well, Lucy."
"When they walked upstairs, John was ready for him. 'Oh, Lord Chancellor, welcome to my poorhouse.' But the poor hapless man, he had cast his testament under his desk. My eye went straight to it. I wonder that eyes didn't follow mine."
An hour's search realised nothing. "So are you sure, John," the Chancellor said, "that you have had none of these new books, because I was informed you had?" And Tyndale lying there, like a poison stain on the tiles. "I don't know who could have told you that," said John Pettit. "I was proud of him," Lucy says, holding out her cup for more wine. "I was proud that he spoke up." Moore said, "It is true I have found nothing today, but you must go with these men. Mr. Lieutenant, will you take him?" John Pettit is not a young man. At Moore's direction, he sleeps on a pad of straw, laid on the flagstones. Visitors have been admitted, only so they can take back to his neighbours the news of how ill he looks.
"We've sent food and warm clothes," Lucy says, "and been turned away on the Lord Chancellor's orders."
"There's a tariff for bribes. You pay the jailers. You need ready money."
"If I do, I shall come to you."
She puts the cup down on his desk.
"He cannot lock us all up."
"He has prisons enough."
"For bodies, yes. But what are bodies? He can take our goods, but God will prosper us. He can close the booksellers, but still there will be books. They have their old bones, their glass saints in windows, their candles and shrines, but God has given us the printing press."
Her cheeks glow. She glances down to the drawings on his desk.
"What are these, Master Cromwell?"
"The plans for my garden. I'm hoping to buy some of the houses at the back of here. I want the land." She smiles.
"A garden. It is the first pleasant thing I've heard of in a while."
"I hope you and John will come and enjoy it."
"And this? You're going to build a tennis court?"
"If I get the ground. And here, you see, I mean to plant an orchard." Tears well into her eyes.
"Speak to the king. We count on you."
He hears a footstep. Joanne's. Lucy's hand flies to her mouth.
"God forgive me. For a moment I took you for your sister."
"The mistake is made," Joanne says, "and sometimes persists. Mistress Pettit, I am very sorry to hear your husband is in the Tower. But you have brought this on yourselves. You people were the first to throw calumnies at the late Cardinal. But now I suppose you wish you had him back." Lucy goes out without a further word. Only one long look over her shoulder. Outside, he hears Mercy greet her. She will get a more sisterly word there. Joanne walks to the fire and warms her hands.
"What does she think you can do for her?"
"Go to the king, or to Lady Anne."
"And will you?"
"Do not," she says, "do not do it." She scrubs away a tear with her knuckle. Lucy has upset her.
"Moore will not rack him. Word will get out, and the city would not have it. But he may die anyway."
She glances up at him.
"She is quite old, you know, Lucy Pettit. She ought not to wear grey. Do you see how her cheeks have fallen in? She won't have any more children."
"I get the point," he says. Her hand clenches on her skirt.
"But what if he does? What if he does rack him, and he gives names?"
"What's that to me?" He turns away. "He already knows my name." He speaks to Lady Anne. "What can I do?" she asks, and he says, "You know how to please the king, I suppose." She laughs and says, "What, my maidenhead for a grocer?" He speaks to the king when he is able, but the king gives him a blank stare and says the Lord Chancellor knows his business. Anne says, "I have tried. I myself, as you know, have put Tyndale's books into his hand, his royal hand. Could Tyndale, do you think, come back into this kingdom? In winter they negotiated, letters crossing the Channel. In spring, Stephen Vaughan, his man in Antwerp, set up a meeting. Evening, the conceding dusk, a field outside the city walls. Cromwell's letter, put into his hand. Tyndale wept. 'I want to come home,' he said. 'I am sick of this. Hunted city to city, and house to house. I want to come home, and if the king would just say yes, if he would say yes to the scriptures in our mother tongue, he can choose his translator. I will never write more. He can do with me what he pleases, torture me or kill me, but only let the people of England hear the gospel.'" Henry has not said no. He had not said never. Though Tyndale's translation and any other translation is banned, he may one day permit a translation to be made by a scholar he approves. How can he say less? He wants to please Anne. But summer comes, and he, Cromwell, knows he has gone to the brink and must feel his way back. Henry is too timid. Tyndale too intransigent. His letters to Stephen sound a note of panic. Abandon ship. He does not mean to sacrifice himself to Tyndale's truculence. Dear God, he says, Moore, Tyndale, they deserve each other. These mules that pass for men. Tyndale will not come out in favour of Henry's divorce, nor for that matter will the monk Luther. You'd think they'd sacrifice a fine point of principle to make a friend of the King of England. But no. And when Henry demands, Who is Tyndale to judge me? Tyndale snaps a message back, quick as word can fly. One Christian man may judge another. A cat may look at a king, he says. He is cradling Marlinspike in his arms and talking to Thomas Avery, the boy he's teaching his trade. Avery has been with Stephen Vaughan, so he can learn the practice among the merchants over there, but any boat may bring him to Austin Friars with his little bag, inside it a woolen jerkin, a few shirts. When he comes clattering in, he shouts out for Mercy, for Joanne, for the little girls, for whom he brings comfits and novelties from street traders. On Richard, on Rafe, on Gregory, if he's about, he lands a few punches by way of saying, I'm back, but always he keeps his bag tucked under his arm. The boy follows him into his office.
Did you never feel homesick, Master, when you were on your travels?
He shrugs. I suppose if I'd had a home. He puts the cat down, opens the bag. He fishes up on his finger a string of rosary beads. For show, says Avery, and he says, good boy. Marlinspike leaps onto his desk. He peers into the bag, dabbing with a paw.
The only mice in there are sugar ones.
The boy pulls the cat's ears, tussles with him.
We don't have any little pets in Master Vaughan's house.
He's all business, Stephen, and very stern these days.
He says, Thomas Avery, what time did you get in last night? Have you written to your master? Been to Mass?
As if he cares for the Mass.
It's all but, how's your bowels?
Next spring you can come home. As they speak, he is unrolling the jerkin. With a shake he turns it inside out, and with a small pair of scissors begins to slit open a seam. Neat stitching. Who did this? The boy hesitates. He colours.
Yenica.
He draws out from the lining the thin folded paper, unwraps it. She must have good eyes.
She does.
And lovely eyes too. He glances up, smiling. The boy looks him in the face. For a moment he seems startled, as if he will speak. Then he drops his gaze and turns away. Just tormenting you, Tom. Don't take it to heart. He is reading Tyndale's letter. If she is a good girl and in Stephen's household, what harm?
What does Tyndale say?
You carried it without reading it.
I would rather not know, in case.
In case you found yourself Thomas More's guest. He holds the letter in his left hand. His right hand curls loosely into a fist. Let him come near my people. I'll drag him out of his court at Westminster and beat his head on the cobbles till I knock into him some sense of the love of God and what it means. The boy grins and flops down on a stool. He, Cromwell, glances again at the letter. Tyndale says, he thinks he can never come back, even if my Lady Anne were queen. A project he does nothing to aid, I must say. He says he would not trust a safe conduct, even if the king himself were to sign it, while Thomas More is alive and in office. Because More says, you need not keep a promise you have made to a heretic. Here, you may as well read. Our Lord Chancellor respects neither ignorance nor innocence. The boy flinches, but he takes the paper. What a world is this, where promises are not kept. He says gently, tell me, who is Yenica? Do you want me to write to her father for you?
No.
Avery looks up, startled. He is frowning.
No, she's an orphan. Master Vaughan keeps her at his own charge. We're all teaching her English.
No money to bring you, then?
The boy looks confused. I suppose Stephen will give her a dowry.
The day is too mild for a fire. The hour is too early for a candle. In lieu of burning, he tears up Tyndale's message. Marlinspike, his ears pricked, chews a fragment of it. Brother Cat, he says, he ever loved the scriptures. Scriptura sola. Only the gospel will guide and console you. No use praying to a carved post or lighting a candle to a painted face. Tyndale says gospel means good news. It means singing, it means dancing, within limits, of course. Thomas Avery says,
can I truly come home next spring?
John Pettit at the Tower is to be allowed to sleep in a bed. No chance, though, that he will go home to Lion's Key. Cranmer said to him, when they were talking late one night, St. Augustine says we need not ask where our home is, because in the end we all come home to God. Lent saps the spirits, as of course it is designed to do. Going in again to Anne, he finds the boy Mark, crouched over his lute and picking at something doleful. He flicks a finger against his head as he breezes past, and says, cheer it up, can't you? Mark almost falls off his stool. It seems to him they are in a daze, these people, vulnerable to being startled, to being ambushed. Anne, waking out of her dream, says,
what did you just do?
Hit Mark, only, he demonstrates, with one finger. Anne says,
Mark, who? Oh, is that his name?
The spring, 1531. He makes it his business to be cheerful. The cardinal was a great grumbler, but he always grumbled in some entertaining way. The more he complained, the more cheerful his man Cromwell became. That was the arrangement. The king is a complainer, too. He has a headache. The Duke of Suffolk is stupid. The weather is too warm for the time of year. The country is going to the dogs. He's anxious, too, afraid of spells, and of people thinking bad thoughts about him in any specific or unspecific way. The more anxious the king becomes, the more tranquil becomes his new servant, the more hopeful, the more staunch. And the more the king snips and carps, the more do his petitioners seek out the company of Cromwell, so unfailing in his amiable courtesy. At home, Jo comes to him looking perplexed. She is a young lady now with a womanly frown, a soft crinkle of flesh on her forehead, which Joanne, her mother, has too.
Sir, how shall we paint our eggs at Easter?
How did you paint them last year?
Every year before this, we gave them hats like the cardinals.
She watches his face, to read back the effect of her words. It is his own habit exactly, and he thinks, not only your children are your children.
Was he wrong?
Not at all. I wish I'd known. I would have taken him one. He would have liked it. Jo puts her soft little hand into his. It is still a child's hand, the skin scuffed over the knuckles, the nails bitten. I am of the king's council now, he says. You can paint crowns if you like. This piece of folly with her mother, this ongoing folly, it has to stop. Joanne knows it too. She used to make excuses, to be where he was. But now, if he's at Austin Friars, she's at the house in Stepney.
Mercy knows,
she murmurs in passing. The surprises, it took her so long. But there is a lesson here. You think people are always watching you, but that is guilt, making you jump at shadows. But finally Mercy finds she has eyes in her head, and a tongue to speak, and picks a time when they can be alone.
They tell me that the king has found a way around at least one of his stumbling blocks. I mean the difficulty of how he can marry Lady Anne, when her sister Mary has been in his bed.
We have had all the best advice, he says easily. Dr. Cranmer, at my recommendation, sent to Venice to a learned body of rabbis to take opinions on the meaning of the ancient texts.
So it is not incest, unless you have actually been married to one sister.
The divines say not.
How much did that cost?
Dr. Cranmer wouldn't know. The priests and the scholars go to the negotiating table. Then some less godly sort of man comes after them with a bag of money. They don't have to meet each other, coming in or going out.
It hardly helps your case, she says bluntly.
There is no help in my case.
She wants to talk to you, Joanne.
What's there to say? We all know it can go nowhere. Even though her husband, John Williamson, is still coughing. One is always half listening for it, here and at Stepney. The annunciatory wheezing on a stairway or in the next room. One thing about John Williamson, he'll never take you by surprise. Dr. Butts has recommended him country air, and keeping away from fumes and smoke. It was a moment of weakness, he says. Then, what? Another moment. God sees all, so they tell me.
You must listen to her.
Mercy's face, when she turns back, is incandescent.
You owe her that.
The way it seems to me, it seems like part of the past. Joanne's voice is unsteady. With a little twitch of her fingers, she settles her half-moon hood and drifts her veil, a cloud of silk, over one shoulder.
For a long time, I didn't think Liz was really gone. I expected to see her walk in one day.
It has been a constant temptation to him to have Joanne beautifully dressed, and he has dealt with it by, as Mercy says, throwing money at the London goldsmiths and mercers, so the women of Austin Friars are bywords among the city wives, who say behind their hands, but with a worshipful murmur, almost a genuflection, "Dear God, Thomas Cromwell, the money must be flowing in like the grace of God."
"So now I think," she says, "that what we did because she was dead, when we were shocked, when we were sorry, we have to leave off that now. I mean, we are still sorry. We will always be sorry."
He understands her. Liz died in another age, when the cardinal was still in his pomp, and he was the cardinal's man.
"If," she says, "you would like to marry, Mercy has her list. But then you probably have your own list, with nobody on it we know."
"If, of course," she says, "if John Williamson had, God forgive me, but every winter I think it is his last, then of course I, without question, I mean, at once, Thomas, as soon as decent, not clasping hands over his coffin, but then the church wouldn't allow it. The law wouldn't."
"You never know," he says.
She throws out her hands. Words flood out of her.
"They say you intend to, what you intend, to break the bishops and make the king head of the church, and take away his revenues from the Holy Father, and give them to Henry. Then Henry can declare the law if he likes, and put off his wife as he likes, and marry Lady Anne. And he will say what is a sin, and what not, and who can be married. And the Princess Mary, God defend her, will be a bastard. And after Henry, the next king will be whatever child that lady gives him."
"Joanne, when Parliament meets again, would you like to come down and tell them what you've just said? Because it would save a lot of time."
"You can't," she says, aghast. "The Commons will not vote it. The Lords will not. Bishop Fisher will not allow it. Archbishop Warham, the Duke of Norfolk, Thomas More."
"Fisher is ill. Warham is old. Norfolk, he said to me only the other day, 'I am tired, if you will permit his expression, of fighting under the banner of Catherine's stained bedsheet. And if Arthur could enjoy her, or if he couldn't, who gives a... who cares any more?'" He's rapidly altering the Duke's words, which were coarse in the extreme. "Let my niece Anne come in," he said, "and do her worst."
"What is her worst?"
Joanne's mouth is ajar. The Duke's words will be rolling down Gracechurch Street, rolling to the river and across the bridge, till the painted ladies in Southwark are passing them mouth to mouth like ulcers. But that's the Howards for you. That's the Boleyns. With or without him, News of Anne's character will reach London and the world. She provokes the king's temper, he says. He complains Catherine never in her life spoke to him as Anne does. Norfolk says she uses language to him you wouldn't use to a dog.
Jeez, you. I wonder he doesn't whip her.
Perhaps he will, when they're married. Look, if Catherine were to withdraw her suit from Rome, if she were to submit to judgment of her case in England, or if the Pope were to concede to the King's wishes, then all this, everything you've said, it won't happen, it will be just... His hand makes a smooth, withdrawing motion, like the rolling up of a parchment. If Clement were to come to his desk one morning, not quite awake, and sign with his left hand some piece of paper he's not read, well, who could blame him? And then I leave him, we leave him, undisturbed, in possession of his revenues, in possession of his authority, because now Henry only wants one thing. That is Anne in his bed. But time marches on, and he's beginning to think, believe me, of other things he might want.
Yes, like his own way.
He's a king. He's used to it.
And if the Pope is still stubborn?
He'll go begging for his revenue.
Will the king take the money of Christian people? The king is rich.
There you are wrong. The king is poor.
Oh, does he know it?
I'm not sure he knows where his money comes from, or where it goes. While my Lord Cardinal was alive, he never wanted for a jewel in his hat, or a horse, or a handsome house. Henry Norris keeps his privy purse. But besides that, he has too much of a hand in the revenue for my liking. Henry Norris, he tells her before she can speak, is the bane of my life. He is always, he does not add, with Anne when I need to see her alone.
I suppose if Henry wants his supper, he can come here. Not this Henry Norris. I mean Henry our pauper king.
She stands up. She sees herself in the glass. She ducks, as if shy of her own reflection, and arranges her face into an expression lighter, more curious and detached, less personal. He sees her do it, lift her eyebrows a fraction, curve up her lips at the corner. I could paint her, he thinks, if I had the skill. I have looked at her so long, but looking doesn't bring back the dead. The harder you look, the faster and the further they go. He had never supposed Liz Wicks was smiling down from heaven on what he was doing with her sister. No, he thinks, what I've done is push Liz into the dark. And something comes back to him that Walter once said, that his mother used to say her prayers to a little carved saint she'd had in her bundle when she came down as a young woman from the north. And she used to turn it away before she got into bed with him. Walter had said, "Dear God, Thomas, it was Saint fucking Felicity, if I'm not mistaken, and her face was to the wall for sure the night I got you." Joanne walks about the room. It is a large room and filled with light.
"All these things," she says, "these things we have now, the clock, that new chest you had Stephen send you from Flanders, the one with the carving of the birds and flowers. I heard with my own ears you say to Thomas Avery, 'Oh, tell Stephen I want it. I don't care what it costs.' All these painted pictures of people we don't know, all these, I don't know what, lutes, and books of music. We never used to have them. When I was a girl, I never used to look at myself in the mirror, but now I look at myself every day. And a comb. You gave me an ivory comb. I never had one of my own. Liz used to plait my hair and push it under my hood, and then I did hers. And if we didn't look how we ought to look, somebody soon told us. Why are we so attached to the severities of the past? Why are we so proud of ourselves for having endured our fathers and our mothers, the fireless days, the meatless days, the cold winters and the sharp tongues? It's not as if we had a choice. Even Liz, once when they were young, when she'd seen him early in the morning putting Gregory's shirt to warm before the fire, even Liz had said sharply, 'Don't do that. He'll expect it every day.' He says,
Liz, I mean Joanne.